I'm going to make Mike very happy. Warning, I'm raising the mic. Yeah, thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone. We're sitting behind the Turnblads today, and I don't know what it is about sitting behind the choir director that makes you, when you're singing during the songs, cognizant of whether your voice is cracking, whether or not you're, you know, going out of tune, in and out of tune. I don't know what it is. Is it just me? I'm paranoia? Yeah, just me, probably. As many of you know, I do have a fairly musical family. My daughter Courtney plays piano and guitar. Jordan plays piano and the trumpet. Both of them sing. My wife Elizabeth, although she doesn't play as much as she used to, does play the piano and flute. Flute. She doesn't play that very often, so I'm like, flute, right? It is flute. I haven't heard it for a long time. Now, me, I'm kind of the oddball of the family. I play the radio. That's about the extent of my musical talent. I love music. I love listening to music. The hearing part's not the problem. It's the production part that, for me, is the problem with music. Not that I haven't given it a shot, mind you. In fact, I think I've shared this with a few people over the years, but most of you may not know that I at one time had a brief stint as a member of the Young Ambassadors. Now, some of you who weren't here during the worldwide days may not know who the Young Ambassadors were. They were a singing group that the church had that traveled around to various church areas. They were made up of college students out in the colleges, or the church's college in Pasadena, Big Sandy. And they were prominent in the Feast Festival film every year at the Feast. No, I wasn't the mascot. I wasn't Big Beak. Although I can say Young Ambassadors, that's about the extent. That wasn't me. I was actually a full-fledged singing member of the group. I became a member quite by accident. It was on a dare, really. I tried out. A friend goaded me into trying out. And so I decided, okay, just for fun, I'll give it a shot. He wanted someone to go along with him. He was nervous, and I said, all right, there's no way I'm going to make it. I know he was going to make it. This guy could sing circles around a lot of people. So I was just doing it for kicks. To my shock and my awe and my horror, I made it. I was selected. Now, I don't think it had anything to do with my singing. I think I somehow managed to maybe hold a note or stay in tune that day for whatever reason, but that still wasn't the reason. What I had heard later is that year they were looking for bigger guys that could lift the young ladies over their heads because they were doing more physical dance routines, and so they wanted somebody who could actually do the lifting. And so I became a young ambassador that year. And for most of the year, to be honest, I was scared spitless. I didn't know what I did. I was leaning next to the guy trying to hear the bass note that I could try to somehow follow along and make it through. But scared spitless is kind of a literal term. I remember one time, college dance. Each of us on the ambassadors group, we had to sing a solo at one of the school dances in front of the whole student body dancing in front of us. And so we had to select one song and prepare for it. So I was just like, what am I going to do? And I went and looked for the song with the least number of notes, the most monotone, and with the most repetitive chorus, so I could just sing the same thing over and over as much as possible. And I found a song like that, and I also found a song that, by the way, was mostly whistling. I thought, I could whistle. Can't sing, but I could whistle, right? That should be easy enough. Well, that's what I thought. I was wrong. So I'm standing in front of the student body. I have my song, and the first four or five measures of the song are whistling. It was a song by Roger Whittaker called New World in the Morning. And so I went to whistle, and nothing came out. And Ross Judson, who was playing on his piano in the background, is giving me a funny look, and I'm looking behind me, and finally he leans forward mercifully and starts whistling for me, and I just stood there. And then got to where I went to sing. Anyway, needless to say, I wasn't in the group the following year. That was my first and only stint of being in a singing group at all, singing in public. except for maybe in the showers, not in public, hopefully, not in the showers, not in public, but with my kids, my family, in the car, long trips, that type of thing. You know, that was where I sang. And so why am I sharing all this with you? Well, many of us, if not most of us, have things, we have our own areas in life that make us feel intimidated, that make us feel someone inadequate, don't we? Areas where maybe we don't feel we quite measure up. And maybe for you it's not music. We have a lot of musical talent here. Maybe it's something else. Maybe it's being a parent intimidates you. Maybe you don't feel like you measure up. Maybe it's as a wife or a husband. Maybe as a younger adult or a teen, you have a hard time, or you don't feel inadequate when you're conversing with older adults. And maybe the opposite is true. You're an adult and you just don't feel quite at ease. You don't feel quite confident talking to younger people, to teens or young adults, not knowing how to act or what to say. Some of us might have a sense of inadequacy about our jobs, our careers. You know, there's actually identified, and it's been in the news, I think, over the last few years quite a bit, a syndrome called imposter syndrome. And imposter syndrome is identified as a symptom where you doubt your accomplishments and you have a persistent internalized fear of being exposed as a fraud. Ever felt like an imposter on the job? Ever felt like maybe not on your job, maybe in a certain project you've been given on a job or responsibility? Maybe feeling it a little over your head, dreading someone might find out that you really don't have a clue what you're doing? That's imposter syndrome. Turn, if you would, over to 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel 15. Today I want to take a look at a couple of examples from Scripture of men who I think felt very much that way at times. And through their stories, I think we can learn what the Bible has to teach us about how to handle and how not to respond and how to respond to areas of our lives where we might feel we don't measure up, or we might feel intimidated or inadequate, areas that where our response determines the type of servant we can be in the responsibilities our God has called us to do and to be. Here in 1 Samuel 15, we find Saul, whom Samuel had anointed king over Israel. And we know a lot about the story. We've heard it often. We know Saul had some issues. On more than one occasion, he directly disobeyed God's commands given through Samuel. On one occasion, when he'd been told to wait for Samuel to arrive to give an offering before doing battle with the Philistines, we know he grew impatient when Samuel didn't show up right away, and he took matters into his own hands because he was afraid that the Israelites were going to scatter because the Philistines were starting to encroach, get it closer, and in a panic, he decided he was going to offer himself, do the offer himself against God's commands. Here in 1 Samuel 15, we find another occasion. God, through Samuel, had commanded Saul to wipe out the Amalekites, and Saul chose to disobey again. And Samuel, again, had to confront him. So let's listen to his reasoning for disobeying God's direct commands. I think we'll find a common theme here. 1 Samuel 15, verse 20, it says, "And Saul said to Samuel, 'But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites, but the people took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, and the best things which should have been utterly destroyed to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal.' And so Samuel said, 'Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king.' And then Saul said to Samuel, 'I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice.'" Notice, again, he feared the people. He was intimidated by them. He was afraid he couldn't control them. He didn't know what to do. And so he had a response. It was the wrong response. Verse 25, continuing, says, "Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. So simply put, Saul felt inadequate. He felt over his head in dealing with the rule, his role as leader over the people. And you could say he had a form of what we could say is imposter syndrome. He felt wholly inadequate for the task he'd been given, somewhat over his head, and his response to those feelings were his undoing as king. But his sense of inadequacy was destructive not just to him, but to other people, to and ultimately to the entire nation of Israel. Let's turn over to 1 Samuel 18 and continue our story. 1 Samuel 18. Now God had determined to replace Saul with another king. David was that king, as we know, and through a series of circumstances, beginning with David's slaying of Goliath, David was brought into this, you know, relationship with Saul, and David begins having some success. He begins growing in popularity with the people, and he had success in areas where Saul had not. And this was when David's sense of Saul's sense of inadequacy became not just destructive to himself, but it became toxic to the whole environment and to others. Let's read here in 1 Samuel 18, verse 5. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. And now it had happened as they were coming home when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistine that the woman had come out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, with musical instruments. And so the woman sang as they danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his ten thousands. It's interesting, you know, thinking about how when they were writing that song, did they not know, you know, how this was going to go over with the king? Well, it didn't go over very well. And then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David ten thousands, and to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? And so Saul eyed David from that day forward. And at first read, you know, here might seem that Paul was worried that David could be attempting some kind of a coup. After all, it's not uncommon. This kind of thing happens in nations from time to time. In fact, it happens today among nations. You know, military leaders get public acclaim, popularity, the backing of the people, and before you know it, they're trying to take over rulership. But there's something else here at work. Continuing on in verse 10, we read, and it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. So David played music with his hand, as at the other times, and there was a spear in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, I will pin David to the wall. But David escaped his presence twice, and now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. And notice it says here, Saul was afraid of David. Again, we see that theme. He was afraid because the Lord was with him. Inadequacy, a sense of intimidation. He saw David excelling in areas he had not and could not, and because of his own fear, because of his own weakness, when it came to controlling the people, not knowing how to respond, feeling like he didn't quite measure up or it wasn't adequate to the task. Let's read on, verse 13. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and made him his captain over 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people, and David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Therefore, when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. Again, afraid of him. David knew how to handle himself with the people, where Saul had continually just bumbled along, stumbled along. David seemed natural. So what did Saul do next? Verse 16. All Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. And then Saul said to David, here is my older daughter Merab, and I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. And so Saul wanted to find a way to do away with David. Notice he didn't do it overtly. He became too afraid to do that himself again. He tried this time to do it, find a covert way to do it. Subtle ways to destroy David, getting others to do his dirty work for him. And isn't that how really toxic inadequacy works? And that's how it causes people to respond. It becomes toxic when it moves on from just holding us back from trying to do undermine our own efforts, you know, to make excuses for ourselves for doing what God says, and causes us to reach out to those who are doing what God says, who are serving, who are contributing, who are finding success, and seeks to discredit them, their efforts. Little comments here, little insinuations, little criticisms behind their back. Not only hurting the person they're criticizing, but creating kind of a toxic negative environment and a spite that poisons everyone around them with whom they come in contact. And in this case, in the case of Israel, the entire nation. And it could be a family, it could be a community, it could be a neighborhood, it could be a church for that matter. So it seems from what we've read in God's Word so far, in this example of Saul, that having emotions and feelings of inadequacy isn't really a great thing, is it? I mean, or rather, we should say at least the wrong response to those kind of emotions. They can be incredibly destructive, potentially, to ourselves and to others. But are all feelings of inadequacy, of not measuring up, are they destructive? And if not, what is a healthy, or is there a healthy response to feelings of intimidation, feelings of feeling of inadequacy that we sometimes have and we deal with, a sense of maybe not measuring up in certain areas? And if it is, there is a healthy response, what is that? What does that look like? Well, turn, if you would, over to 2 Corinthians 11. We'll take a look at another example, a decidedly contrasting example. 2 Corinthians 11. Here in 2 Corinthians 11, we learn of the Apostle Paul about a time when he faced, I think, feelings very much the same, feelings of being inadequate to the task that he was given. But what a contrast in the way that he responded and to the way that we see a man like Saul respond. Before we read Paul's words here, I think it's important to understand the context. And Paul's credibility here was under attack when he wrote this second letter to the Christians at Corinth. Certain people were attempting to undermine him, to discredit his legitimacy as an apostle and a minister of the gospel. And they were trying to undermine his influence in order to draw people away, draw the Corinthian brethren away from him and bringing them into their own orbit of influence. And what were the arguments that they were using? Well, Paul's previous letter, as we know, 1 Corinthians, was quite confrontational. There were a lot of things going on in the Corinthian church that Paul needed to address. There was some arguments, debating, there was sexual immorality, quarrels, lawsuits, brother against brother. There was just a lot of chaos. And so Paul's had to address, in addressing these things, he was pretty pointed. He was pretty harsh in his first letter, pretty corrective. Another reason in his second letter was to the Corinthians, he expressed concern for how this previous letter had affected them and how it had been received. And he was seeking in the second letter to really encourage them in the faith, to say, you know, how pleased he was at their response to his first letter, how they had kind of turned the corner, to express his love to them. And so there was this issue about his first letter that was still hanging around, apparently. In his second letter, he also expressed concern about how some people were misrepresenting his failure to visit them. He'd planned to visit them, he'd promised to visit them, but it hadn't worked out. He'd been hampered in doing so, and you know, he'd failed to make good on that promise. And apparently some people were using those things, the hard letter that he'd written, the aborted trip, as a way to create dissent about Paul's, and undermine Paul's authority. They're saying, you know, Paul doesn't really love you. He doesn't really care about you. I mean, look at the letter he wrote. Look how harsh he was. You know, and his second letter doesn't make up for that. And if he was a true apostle, he would be here. He would be visiting you. He'd make every effort to build you up, to be here. What credibility does he have? You need to follow us. We have better credentials for leadership than he does. And so Paul, in this second letter, really takes the opportunity to respond to this criticism. And he did so by beginning to play on the same carnal playing ground that they were playing on. He began by meeting them on their own level and began listing his credentials for an apostle from a physical perspective, sparring with them on that kind of that carnal level. But then, as you'll see, he takes it to a decidedly different direction. Let's read in 2 Corinthians 11, beginning in verse 16, with that context in mind. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 16. I say again, let no one think me a fool, if otherwise at least receive me as a fool, that I also may boast a little. What I speak not according to the Lord, but as it were foolishly in this confidence of boasting. Seeing that many boast according to the flesh, I will also boast. And jumping down to verse 22, he says, are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more, in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. From the Jews 5 times I received 40 stripes minus 1. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I had been in the deep, in journeys often, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea. Okay, Paul, we get it. Right? We got the point. Made his case. Paul's saying, you know, you want to talk about credentials? Bring it on. Bring it on. You have nothing on me. I've been through more than all of you put together. I've suffered for the gospel more than you can imagine. And if that's the standard you want to use, if that's how you want to boast, let's fight. Let's get it on. But then Paul ends that line of carnal reasoning. And the next few passages here are pretty powerful. He puts aside the folly. He stops playing the game and he reveals what it is he really from a spiritual level and a personal level has to boast about and what he should boast about and what really provided him with the true credentials as an apostle of Christ. He says in verse 30, if I must boast, if you really want to know what qualifies me, it's none of those things I listed, right? That's kind of the inference here. If I must boast, I'll boast in the things which concern my infirmity. Your infirmity? That must have kind of made them do a double take. It's quite a statement. You know, there's nothing I am, nothing I bring to the table, none of the accomplishments that I've had, the suffering I've endured for the gospel, that adds anything to my credentials for being a servant of Christ more than this. It's my infirmities, it's my weaknesses that make the difference, that make me uniquely qualified. That's kind of an interesting tactic if you think about it, and one most of us probably wouldn't resort to. Can you imagine resorting to that tactic at your next job interview? You know, you made your case about how great you are for the company and what abilities you bring to the company, and you said, you know, but the real thing that makes me the best candidate is I got all kinds of weaknesses. How will that go over? Well, probably not well in our carnal world, but in Paul's case, it was exactly the point he needed to make. How do those weaknesses qualify Paul for the task? How did they qualify him for the role he was given? Well, reading on, verse 31. The God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. So he begins to share a story here. At first glance, it's not clear where he's going with this or how it applies, but we'll dig into it. In verse 32, in Damascus, the governor, under Aretas the king, was guarding the city of the Damascenes with a garrison desiring to arrest me. But I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped from his hands. And so what Paul's describing here is actually the first time, his first attempt to preach the gospel out of the gate. His first attempt to preach the gospel. And it's not really clear, just reading this account, what this event had to do with Paul's weaknesses. I mean, really, you know, it kind of sounds like it was a harrowing event, doesn't it? He was let down out of the basket, out of the gate in a basket, trying to preach the gospel, chased out of the city. I mean, really, what sounds like a harrowing event, nothing to be ashamed of, or anything pointing to a weakness. Well, to understand really where Paul's coming from, you have to go back to the original story where this account is told in Acts. So let's go there. Acts chapter 9. Acts chapter 9. And we'll read beginning in verse 20. Acts 9, verse 20, where the story is recounted in detail. It says, immediately after he preached the Christ in the synagogues, that he is the Son of God, Then all who heard were amazed and said, "Is this not he who destroyed those who call on his name in Jerusalem and has come here for that purpose, so that he might bring them bound to the chief priests?" But Saul increased all the more in strength, and he confounded the Jews who dwelt in Damascus, proving that this Jesus is the Christ. Okay, so failure? Really? Weakness? Doesn't sound like it, does it? I mean, he overpowered and he baffled his opponents. He was able to prove to the Jews without uncertainty that Jesus is the Christ. Sounds like success to me. Doesn't sound like failure at all. How did that show weakness? Well, the next verse explains it. It says, "After many days had gone by, the Jews conspired to kill him, but his followers took him by night and lowered him in a basket through an opening in the wall." So think about this for a moment. Even though Paul had proven that Jesus was the Christ, was that his primary goal? Was that what he was there to do? I mean, was he there to prove a case, in one sense, to argue a case? His goal wasn't to stump them. His goal wasn't to confound them, to box them in a corner so they'd come out fighting, to convict them of the truth that they didn't agree with. His goal in preaching the gospel was to make disciples, right? To make disciples, to draw people to the gospel. But the effect of his approach seemingly was a little bit not quite adequate to the task, perhaps a little overpowering, perhaps a little too free with intellect, proving himself to be smarter or wiser, to argue and debate and to win over them. But it had the opposite effect. It angered them to the point to where they turned on him and they sought to kill him and to force him to run and to flee. Now we're told that those who hear the gospel are going to reject it, right? There's going to be persecution about the gospel message itself. There are those who are going to be angered and there's going to be persecution. But it seems here in this case that it wasn't necessarily the gospel primarily that was causing the reaction. It was Paul's presentation of the gospel. And we read on here in Acts, in verse 28, from Damascus, Paul went to Jerusalem. And he didn't change anything. He took pretty much the same tact. Acts 9:28 says, "So that when he was with them at Jerusalem, coming in and going out, and he spoke boldly in the name of the Lord Jesus and disputed against the Hellenists, but they attempted to kill him." So he spoke boldly and he disputed. So this new convert was it seems, becoming more trouble than he was worth. Why? Why do I say that? Well, in verse 30, here's what the inference that we're told there was a problem. He says, "When the brethren found out, they brought him down to Caesarea and they sent him out to Tarsus." And notice after he was gone, verse 31, "Then the churches throughout Judea, Galilee, and Samaria had peace and they were edified." And I think we could read that as a polite way of saying, phew, he's gone. Now we can finally breathe a little more easily. And Paul's seemingly disputing, confrontational approach, and as I'm saying this, you might say, really, was it confrontational? Wasn't he just preaching it boldly and powerfully? We'll get to that and show a distinct contrast between this way of preaching and the way that he later preached, and you'll see the difference. The brethren, that church felt that he had to get him out of there because he was putting the entire church at risk. And they did. Paul spent the next year laying low in Tarsus and Arabia until Barnabas went and found him and brought him to Antioch. An entire year spent away reflecting on, what God was doing with him, his approach to preaching the gospel and being a tool in God's hands. Think about that year. Think about how Paul must have felt at that point. Here he was, flush with excitement, flush with enthusiasm, surely, about his new faith and his commission given him by God. And he finds himself having to run for his life on two occasions, doing more damage than good, being pushed into hiding by the brethren. He wants nothing more than to serve and to be a minister of the gospel on their behalf. And quite a setback, I would think, emotionally. How inadequate do you think he may have felt for the task at that moment? How would you have felt, potentially, in his shoes? But what was Paul's response? How did he respond to the realization that he didn't quite have it right? He didn't quite measure up, at least initially, to the obvious task, to the task he was been given. Turn over, if you would, to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. You know, rather than cause him to take that same that route that Saul took in the same situation, who or might have taken, to possibly cut corners, to disobey God, to run, take things into his own hand, lean on his own intellect, which was amazing, to continue to fight that battle, a losing battle, he took a decidedly different direction. And the realization that his own methods were inadequate taught him, I think, a major lesson. In Damascus and Jerusalem, he boldly preached the gospel. He debated, more than likely, using every intellectual tool in his toolbox. He had a vast arsenal. He could tangle with the best of them, but it didn't work. It didn't work for him. It wasn't effective as it should be. He may have confounded their arguments, but he didn't convert anyone, or very few, and they instead turned on him. But by the time he began preaching, his next time out of the gate, preaching to the Corinthians, something had radically changed, and you see it here very clearly. Here we see an entirely different approach taken by Paul. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 1. He says, "And I, brethren, when I came to you, did not come with excellence of speech or of wisdom, declaring to you the testimony of God, for I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I was with you in weakness." It's a different Paul. Not disputing, not arguing. "I was with you in fear and much trembling. And my speech and my preaching were not with persuasive words of human wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith would not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God." Look at the difference. Look at the difference between the harshly, brashly, aggressive man who confronted the Jews in Damascus and the man who took the gospel to the people in Corinth. And Paul says he came to them in weakness. Not that he wasn't capable of being more powerful, coming at them in a more powerful way, but he changed. Instead of relying on himself, his own intellectual ability, which was immense, he looked to the power of God's Spirit to make up for what he lacked. He realized that faith can't stand in man's wisdom, men's credentials, but true faith and the faith that converts, that convicts, that changes, is in the power of God. Quite a contrast. On the one hand, we have a man like Saul whose response to feelings of inadequacy was to hold back on things he should have been doing and take things into his own hand, and to look for ways to undermine others who were trying, like David, who were trying to serve God. And on the other hand, we have a man like Paul who, recognizing his inadequacy, relinquished control, turned to God through the Holy Spirit. He said, "I don't know what I'm doing. I'm wholly inadequate, but you're not." And we trusted in God to make up for what he lacked. Okay, so we've seen two decidedly different examples. One in Saul and one in Paul. How they both responded to their own sense of inadequacy. So what are some key lessons? What are some takeaways, quickly, that we can glean from their stories? There are many we could think of, but I'll come up with a few that I'll share with you in the minutes that we have remaining. Lesson number one. Boast in your weaknesses. Boast in your weaknesses. You know, it's a trait of human nature to go with your strong suit, isn't it? To think about, what are my skills? What are my abilities? What do I bring to the table? We do our best to impress, put our best foot forward. But sometimes, you know, in fact, most of the time, we're at our most effective when we operate from a position of weakness. And we admit we're not all that. Turn, if you would, to Philippians 3. Philippians 3. Paul, you know, readily admitted that his approach in the past to preaching, probably the approach with which he was most comfortable, had been ineffective. And even with all of his intellectual ability, He held all of the zeal, the skillfulness with which he could debate and prove an argument. None of it enabled him to effectively preach the gospel, but by admitting this, and by humbling himself and giving his effort to God, that's when things began to change. That's when he became a tool in God's hands to bring many to Christ. Philippians 3:4 tells us his mindset. It says, though I also might have confidence in the flesh, if anyone else thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, I more so. Circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, concerning the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning righteousness, which is in the law, blameless. Verse 7, but what things were gained to me, these I have accounted as loss for Christ. Yet indeed I also count all things lost for the excellence of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and I count them as rubbish. You know, Paul says that all the things he once counted as gain, his knowledge, education, debating skills, he counts as rubbish. Everything he relied on, they proved inadequate to the task, and he realized that power, Christ's power within him, was much more to be desired and much more effective at winning converts. So as he said, that was reason enough to boast in his weakness. It's true of us too. What do we rely on? What do we look to in ourselves to give us meaning, to feel valuable, to feel like we contribute? How do we feel when those things let us down? Or we feel that those things, we don't measure up like we thought we did or hoped we did? Maybe we don't feel we're the person we wanted to be or we're the person we thought we would. I thought I was good at that thing. I thought it, but it's brought me nothing but failure. I just keep being hit in the face with how inadequate I am. Beaten up by my weaknesses. What good am I? And Paul says, you know, actually, God, and God's telling us this through Paul, don't look at those things. You know, count them as rubbish. Allow yourself to suffer the loss of those things, the loss of yourself, because in that, you'll find he will lift you up and he'll sustain you for the effort and for the work and the task that he has ahead for you. Embrace who you are and what you are in Jesus Christ and the strength that he can provide. So we should boast in our weaknesses because it's the faith we display in the midst of weakness that boasts of God's strength within us. So lesson number one, boast in your weaknesses. Here's another one. Lesson number two, when you're intimidated, when you're feeling inadequate to the task, just move forward in faith. Just move forward in faith. 1 Corinthians 16:9, I want to have you turn there, just a couple quotes just to see Paul's mindset here, where he was with his approach to preaching the gospel. 1 Corinthians 16:9, he writes, for a great and effective door has opened to me, and there are many adversaries. And 2 Corinthians 2:12, he writes, furthermore, when I came to Troas to preach Christ's gospel, and a door was opened to me by the Lord. Okay? So where Saul became panicked by his feelings of inadequacy, taking matters into his own hands, doing whatever he thought to kind of, when he got felt boxed in, didn't know where to go next, and to try to get out of the situation, Paul learned from his failure. He stopped looking for where his talent and ability could take him, and instead began looking for open doors. Saul looked to himself, and Paul looked to God, in short. And we can, and we should do the same. Lesson number two, move forward in faith. Lesson number three, trust God to make up for what you lack. Trust God to make up for what you lack. You know, Paul stopped depending on his own intellect, his own debating skills to bring others to Christ. Sometimes, you know, the best thing we can do when we feel inadequate is just to, you know, take a step back and ask ourselves, you know, am I depending on God in this situation or am I depending on myself? And if it's the former, let go. Let go. Ask God to guide us, to show us a direction, to open the door through His Spirit. and begin to trust again what Romans 8:28 tells us. And it's, you know, a memory scripture. We all know it well, but it's so true. All things work together for the good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. Maybe not immediately, maybe not in the near future, but trusting in him that he'll lead us when and where is appropriate in his time. God can work through our weaknesses to fulfill his purpose for us. We just have to trust him to make up for what we lack. So we need our inadequacies, don't we? We need our weaknesses. It's not our sense of inadequacy. It's not the areas where we feel we don't measure up that hold us back and keep us from moving forward. It's our response to those weaknesses. It's our response to those inadequacies. A healthy sense of personal inadequacy drives us to God. It convicts us of our need for his strength that only his Spirit can provide. And, you know, it's kind of a difficult paradox to embrace, that we're weak when we think we're strong, and we're strong when we know we're weak. It's not intuitive. It's not the way this world thinks, but it's what God would teach us. We must embrace it, though, if we're going to be tools in God's hands that he would have us to be. And I think that's the lesson that we learn here in this example of Saul and Paul. So let's boast in our weaknesses, in our infirmities, in our inadequacies, not letting them hold us back, but learning from them and committing ourselves to move forward in faith, trusting in God to make up where we lack.